This is Sustainable East End, the show about land use, energy and water resources, transportation, and the farming and food industries on Eastern Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, co-producer with Tony Ernst. Hundreds of thousands of homes are at risk of chronic flooding due to sea level rise over the coming decades. The implications for coastal residents, communities, and the economy are profound. We talk with Rachel Cletus of the Union of Concerned Scientists about a report, Underwater, Rising Seas, Chronic Floods, and the Implications for U.S. Coastal Real Estate. Well, Rachel Cletus, welcome to Sustainable East End.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this report, Underwater, from the Union of Concerned Scientists, I think I've been waiting for this report for a long time. It's been several years that I have told folks, you know, sea level rise is going to hit us before we think it's hitting us. And that's very much what this report is about. It's about the economic impacts of the risks of sea level rise as well as the actual sea level rise. Tell us the overall arching purpose of the study.
Well, what we did with this study is we looked at the impacts of accelerating sea level rise in the contiguous U.S., the lower 48 states. And what we found is that sea level rise is accelerating, and it's driven primarily by climate change. And what's happening is we're seeing high tides become more frequent, reaching further inland. Tides are essentially inching higher, and it's this frequent disruptive high tide flooding that's sort of the first sign of the impacts of sea level rise. Well before places go underwater, they're going to start seeing this worsening chronic disruptive flooding. And our study focused specifically on the impacts on properties, homes and commercial properties along the coastline. What we found was that within the next 30 years, within the lifetime of a typical mortgage issued today, more than 300,000 coastal homes with a collective market value today of nearly $118 billion are at risk of chronic high tide flooding.
And you picked the high scenario level for sea level rise. Tell us what that high scenario is.
Yes, our sea level rise scenarios come from NOAA scenarios that were developed for the 2014 National Climate Assessment. And what's important to recognize is that those scenarios, we're on track now for some of the high end of those scenarios. And the reason we picked the high scenario was that we are looking at people's homes, something that's obviously very, very important to people's financial and general well-being. And in those cases, what's advised is to pick a scenario that goes to the most risk-averse end of the spectrum, which is why we picked this high scenario. We also looked at a lower scenario of if the world were to stick to the long-term temperature goals of the Paris Agreement and if land-based ice loss was limited. And that scenario shows us that we can actually limit the harms done by chronic high tide flooding.
By 80%, is that right?
Yes. What's really important to recognize is that we do still have choices, and one of the most important choices we have available to us is making deep cuts in emissions. And if we do that in line with the long-term temperature targets of the Paris Agreement, and if land-based ice loss is limited, we can avert up to 80 to 85% of the damage from chronic inundation to coastal properties.
I mean, that's a huge difference. But I want to ask you about the high-level scenario, because that's 2014, and I have seen research that already puts that into question. So I wonder if the Union of Concerned Scientists, you know, had in the back of your minds that even the high-level scenario may be out of date.
Well, what we used is a sea level rise, a global average sea level rise of 6.6 feet above 1992 levels by the end of the century. That's our high scenario for this particular study we did. But as we know, the eastern Gulf Coast of the U.S. are among the sea level rise hotspots globally. And we did use localized sea level rise projections for our study. And those localized projections in some places, like coastal Louisiana are even higher than these global averages. And as you point out, the latest studies that are coming in, including studies showing that land-based ice loss in the Antarctic is accelerating at a faster rate than scientists had previously thought, all point to, in fact, the potential for even higher sea level rise scenarios, potentially, than we used in our study. So this is all very sobering. And what's key to remember is a lot of the sea level rise that we're going to see through 2045, through mid-century, is essentially baked in based on our past and current emissions. So those are the risks that we know we have a very strong probability of facing. And those are the near-term risks that we also point out in our study that communities around the U.S. have to prepare for, regardless of what happens to our emissions trajectory.
So the 80 to 85% reduction you're really talking about by the end of the century, but we already have the figures that you have in this study underwater is already pretty baked in for 2045.
Yeah, our study has estimates for coastal property at risk of chronic inundation in 2045 and then through the end of the century. Through 2045, unfortunately, we are on course for almost all of that being realized. It's towards the end of the century that we start to see some real potential to limit the losses, up to 80 to 85% potential of limiting the losses if we limit sea level rise.
So now, the report also does not include infrastructure, roads and, you know, power plants and things of that kind. It really just covers residential and commercial coastal properties. Why did you not include infrastructure?
Well, we used, for our study, we used sea level rise projections and looked at chronic inundation. We also used a property layer data set from Zillow, and that's what allowed us to get at the properties at risk. Now, we didn't have the data to do a thorough investigation of infrastructure at risk along our coastline. There's both public and private infrastructure at play. So that's not a data layer that we were able to integrate in this version of our study. But it is important to recognize that there's a lot of stuff on our coastline in addition to properties. There's infrastructure, there's places of great importance from a cultural heritage point of view. There are a lot of ecosystems at risk. And so there is a lot along our coast that's at stake as sea level rises. And so in a sense, our study is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the cost to our economy and our society.
And you really talk about the kind of interconnectedness of the domino effect, we could say, as one thing happens, then another, it leads to another. Let's first talk about the decrease, how the decrease in coastal property values occurs. The report says a property market correction is inevitable, but right now the risk of sea level rise is not being factored in. Talk about, what are the barriers to factoring in the actual risk and when those barriers begin to fall?
Yeah, unfortunately, for the most part, our coastal real estate markets are not really taking this looming risk into account currently. We've got a lot of short-sighted policies and market incentives that are continuing to encourage risky development, mask the risk to homeowners and communities, and essentially leave us less prepared to deal with this challenge. In fact, in many cases, we're finding that more development is happening on the coastline. If you look at Miami, for example, even as we know that these risks are coming our way, we're putting more property and people in harm's way. So we really have to be clear-eyed about these risks and take a different approach. Otherwise, essentially what we see unfolding, and we had a lot of conversations with market experts as well who recognize this as a significant risk, is that there will be some kind of coastal property market correction. It could look different in different places, and it might come as a sharp decline in some cases. In other cases, it might be a slower decline depending on how exposed the place is to the risk. But eventually, markets are going to catch up with the physical reality of this risk. And when that happens, that could be very, very calamitous for some places. It could trigger local housing market crises. Those could become even more widespread because many people have a financial stake in coastal real estate. There's, of course, homeowners first and foremost, but then communities where these homes are located could find that as property values decline, they start to have a lot of their property tax base at risk. So, for example, in our study, we find that the properties at risk by 2045 contribute nearly $1.5 billion towards today's property tax base. So all of that could be at risk. And that property tax base is used to fund vital local services and infrastructure, so communities could suffer as a result. And then there could be more widespread repercussions because there are mortgage lenders who might find now that mortgages are at risk. There are coastal property developers, insurers, and even the taxpayer who ultimately could be on the hook for some of these costs. So the potential implications are pretty widespread.
So property values of, let's say, take our own area here where I'm speaking to you from the east end of Long Island. We have some of our most expensive properties, you know, multi-million dollar properties that are right on the water. You know, that's a beachfront property. That's what people want. Those pay, you know, a large amount of taxes and they go down. Now the taxes are less and the money to fund local needs is now less, which makes the community even less desirable and makes the tax rate fall more heavily on those property owners who are left. Is that what you're talking about?
Absolutely. And this is not just about rich and expensive homes, of course. There are a lot of ordinary middle-class blue-collar folks who live along the coast, and they, too, have a lot of their financial well-being tied up in their home value. And as those home values decline, they stand to be at risk for great financial losses. As you point out, that area of Long Island is an area that's particularly at risk. In our study, we find that by 2045, the three counties that make up most of Long Island, Suffolk, Nassau, and Queens, could encompass nearly 15,000 homes at risk of chronic inundation. And today, there are about 40,000 people who live in those homes, and they're collectively valued today at $7.7 billion. So that's a lot of people, a lot of neighborhoods, a lot of value tied up in the coastal real estate market.
Yes, and it doesn't then only affect the people who live in those homes. I think it's important to reiterate, as you point out, but it's going to affect the community-wide.
Absolutely, because of the property tax base that's at risk, that can have real implications for the community. One other thing that we found was that that community tax base at risk can also make it difficult for communities to raise money on the bond market, which they often turn to fund local infrastructure projects, but even for adaptation measures that communities might want to undertake. If their credit rating starts to slip in the bond market, that makes it even more difficult to raise money to do those kinds of vital things.
You're listening to Sustainable East End. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and our guest today is Rachel Cletus of the Union of Concerned Scientists. We're talking about her new report, Underwater, Rising Seas, Chronic Floods, and the Implications for U.S. Coastal Real Estate. Business owners are also similarly at risk. Talk about some of the impacts to the local economy outside of the impact on homeowners.
Well, yes. So what we found is that there were a lot of instances where when we talked to financial sector experts, what they were telling us is that, look, these mortgages on these homes, because they're at risk from sea level rise, are inherently riskier. And that means that if this risk is flying under the radar, there may be people who are making these mortgage loans, banks that are making these mortgage loans, that aren't fully aware that these are risky mortgages. And in the case, unfortunately, in the case of properties that are at risk from sea level rise, unlike previous housing market crises where property values in most markets tend to rebound eventually, In this case, unfortunately, the property values will only continue to decline further as sea levels rise. And that means that many homeowners might have to make a tough decision to perhaps walk away from their mortgage once the home value declines much below the mortgage. And banks could be left holding the bag. And in that case, those banks, especially if they're small regional banks, might find a lot of their portfolio at risk. The other thing that might happen is that many of these mortgages are federally insured mortgages, in which case the taxpayer could also find themselves exposed should these mortgages start to go underwater.
Literally as well. I mean, figuratively as well as literally underwater.
Absolutely. That is one of the ironies in this case. You know, a term that's used colloquially, underwater mortgages, actually is real in this case as sea levels rise.
Now, you spoke before of working class communities whose properties will also be at risk. Talk about some of the other vulnerable populations that people don't often think about. The impact of income inequality on a working class and poor communities of sea level rise.
Yeah, so there are many communities along our coastline, including in places like New Jersey and Massachusetts and Virginia, Maryland, where we found that 60% or more of the homes at risk within the next 30 years are valued below the state median. So these are ordinary people's homes, and they are at risk, again, from chronic inundation. Another thing we found is that there are nearly 175 communities around the country where 10% or more of their housing stock is at risk from chronic inundation. And of those, nearly 40% currently have poverty levels above the national average. So we're talking about places like coastal Louisiana, where there are very high poverty rates and there's a very high percentage of homes at risk. These are places that are going to have a disproportionate harm because people have even fewer resources to cope with the risks and the aftermath of chronic flooding.
And, you know, this, where I live here on the East End, is largely it's an aging community, perhaps like a lot of resort communities. People are living on fixed incomes. Talk about the impact on elders who may be particularly vulnerable to this kind of economic impact of sea level rise.
Yes, there are a number of places which have a high elderly population. These are people who live on fixed incomes who have a lot of their wealth tied up in the value of their homes and are relying on that to be able to fund their needs, whether they're medical needs or just basic needs, and don't have a lot of other avenues for income. And for people at that stage in their life to take a big financial hit, like losing a big chunk of their property value, could be devastating. And there are places like this, as you point out, where you live. There are also places, for example, on the eastern shore of Maryland, where there is a very high percentage of elderly African-American population that really is even now, not even in the future, but right now, today, experiencing chronic high tide flooding. They've had places where septic tank systems have failed because of saltwater intrusion, and that makes it hard and practically impossible to sell a home. And this is very, very difficult for these isolated rural communities in the eastern shore of Maryland.
Now, talk about what are some of the government policies, market incentives, and kind of investment landscapes that prop up the business as usual choices and that don't account for sea level rise. Because I find that even though, you know, around here, you know, I have a friend, for example, who has a beautiful house on the bay, you know, beautiful view. And you know, I said to him, "You're such a lucky man to live here." And he said, "Yes, I am." And I said, "But are you concerned about sea level rise?" He said, "Oh, well, that's going to happen later on." You know, so people are not really thinking about this. What are some of the policies and, you know, market incentives that keep people from thinking about that?
Well, first and foremost, of course, there's a big draw to living along the coast. This is a very long-standing draw around the world and in the U.S. for a variety of reasons, both cultural and economic. Coastlines are the places that we've developed the most, have a lot of people and property here. But what's happening now in light of sea level rise is we really have to take a fresh look at the choices we're making. And unfortunately, we have a lot of well-intentioned policies as well as market incentives that are distorting people's perception of the risk and are perpetuating risky development and sometimes rebuilding in the wake of storms and disasters right exactly where things were. So this business as usual approach to our coastal economies and living really has to change. And to do that, we're going to have to reorient some of these policies and market incentives. The biggest problem we see is that most people don't know the risk and they don't know how near term the risk is. So we hope our research will help move the dial on that, but it's really critical for homeowners and communities and policymakers and financial sector actors to inform themselves of the risk. We need updated flood risk maps that actually reflect future conditions, including projections of sea level rise. That's not the case for current FEMA flood risk maps, for example. We need more investments ahead of time, not just post-disaster, but ahead of time in flood reduction measures. And we need to make sure that in the aftermath of disasters, the money that we're spending is spent wisely and it helps build resilience rather than just put people right back where they were. We've got to have better systems of disclosure in real estate transactions and other market transactions so that in the course of buying a home, for example, you're more aware of the risks that you face. We have to reform our national flood insurance program so that we're not just continuing to make payouts in places that are highly exposed to risk, that we're also incentivizing voluntary home buyout programs in some of these high-risk areas, that we're helping people invest in flood-proofing measures, both individually as homeowners, but also as communities, and that we're safeguarding our natural environment, things like wetlands and marshes and barrier islands that serve as natural protections against things like storm surge.
So you talk about the need for the federal, state, and local governments to play a role in this communication of risk and in the development of these policies. Parse for us what, you know, the federal government should do, what state government should do, and what local communities can do.
Well, we have a lot of federal programs that, while they were not designed to deal with sea level rise, can be repurposed to help us in this moment address some of these challenges. So many of these federal programs include disaster aid programs, the National Flood Insurance Program, and federal flood risk management standards, et cetera, all of which need to be reformed to reflect the risks of sea level rise. But then we make a lot of decisions at the state and local level around development choices, zoning, building codes, things like that, that really at the local level, again, need to be reoriented to recognize these risks of sea level rise coming our way. And then at the local level, what's really, really important is communicating this risk to homeowners and communities, not in an alarmist way, but in a way that people can then, using that information, make better choices about the future that they would like to see in their communities.
Well, I guess that kind of brings up the main question. I mean, can we continue to live on the coast in an era of sea level rise?
Well, the risks and the exposure to that risk look different along our coastline, so there's no one-size-fits-all policy. But I do think the most important thing people can do is be aware of the risk, and not just the fact that they're exposed to the risk, but what the time frames are. And that's one thing that we really try to parse out in our research, which is point out places that are at risk in the very near term within the next 30 years, so within the lifetime of a typical mortgage issued today, and then places that may have a little bit longer to sort of wrestle with their choices. So the time frames and the risks are really important. And we are going to have to treat this as a national challenge. This is not just about individual communities on our coastline, but how are we as a nation going to rise to this challenge? Yes, in some cases, people will have to consider a retreat from the coastline. But it's not just about pulling back. It's about where do these people go? What are the new economic opportunities? Or where are the new homes going to be? Is it going to be possible to move with a community so that you can maintain your cultural and social ties? These are all questions that will have to be informed by local stakeholders with local communities engaged fully to assess what their options and choices are.
Well, that's terrific. Now, can I just ask you a personal question? I'm calling the Boston area. Do you live in the Boston area?
I do. I live in a suburb of Boston called Arlington. And yes, towards the end of the century, my town too will start to face some of these risks of sea level rise. The Boston area is quite exposed, as you might imagine. Just earlier this year, we had a series of winter storms that showed us that our entire seaport district here in Boston, which is a major area of business revitalization right now, is very much exposed to storm surge. And what our research shows is what we saw in these storms. Many of those same areas by 2060, they're going to be inundated just by regular high tide flooding. So without the power of storm surge, but still the areas that will get inundated will look very similar. And, you know, unfortunately, this is a very forward-looking area that, you know, fully recognizes the risk of sea level rise. And at the same time, we have this very maladaptive development happening in our seaport district here in downtown Boston.
And so for you personally, how have you wrestled with this? If you live in a community that's also vulnerable, what are your thoughts? How do you put this into your own long-term plans?
Well, I have two young children, and I think about their future all the time. It is a driving force for the work that I do. I feel that we really owe this to our children and grandchildren to face this problem head-on, not just in terms of dealing with the impacts of sea level rise and climate change, but also making the decisions to sharply curtail our carbon emissions to help limit these harms. The choice is ours right now, and we really owe it to these future generations to make the right choice by them. I think we have to start these conversations from the local and then put pressure on our policymakers at the state and national level to help communities cope with climate change and limit its impacts. Right now, we have a federal government that has abdicated all responsibility, and it's really reprehensible. So we have to put pressure on our politicians, both the administration and Congress, to do better.
Well, that's a great place to end. Dr. Rachel Cletus, you are an economist and a climate change expert with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Sustainable East End.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Cletus is the author of the report Underwater. Find it at www.uscusa.org. And you can find Sustainable East End programs archived at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and me, Francesca Rhiannon.